now session 4 of The Wisdom of Your Cells, Perception and Survival with Dr. Bruce Lipton.
Our third conclusion is an interesting one because it deals with the concept of evolution. Evolution means that, look, environments change, and since organisms are adapted to the environment, if an environment changes, to survive, an organism must change its structure or die in the process of trying to change, because if it can't accommodate the new environment, it will certainly not be able to thrive in that environment. Well, the issue is, well, how do mutations occur? Because remember, mutations are the events that change the blueprint genes that can change the structural parts of our body so we can use different versions of those in different environments. How do mutations occur? What I was teaching, and the conventional teaching that is in grade school, high school, college, is the concept that mutations are random events. That when we have something called a cancer, it's a random event. That something just happened to us. We're a victim of random events again. And this is based on the fact that, how did we study mutations? Well, we study mutations as a result of changing the genetic code. Yeah, but when do these mutations occur? Conventional understanding reveals this. When a cell is going to divide into two daughter cells, you have to take the billions of the ATs and Cs and Gs that make up the genetic code, copy them precisely, and pass to each daughter a complete identical set of genes. And in so doing, then each daughter cell will propagate the same components that its mother cell had, and this keeps everything the same. However, in copying the DNA, the copy process occasionally results in a miscopying of the DNA. It's essentially like in the old days, before we had the printing press, monks would take a Bible and sit down with pen and paper and copy that Bible onto a new book. And of course, inevitably, in copying the thousands and thousands and thousands of words that are present in the Bible, inevitably there'll be an error, a spelling error, a word would drop out, and this would have profound consequences on the new version of the Bible because the meaning would be altered. So, for example, by just screwing up with one letter, you can change celebrate into celibate, and celibate means completely something very different than celebrate. And yet, what was reality? By making a simple error in the translation of that original code, the new reading could be totally altered in its meaning. So, when cells are copying their DNA, there's a physical device that actually goes through and copies all these bases, the A, T, Cs, and Gs, in the right sequence to make an exact copy. Inevitably, because you're copying billions of these coded letters, mistakes happen. A wrong letter gets in. But a wrong letter in the code will lead to a change in the amino acids, making that beaded pop bead sequence called the protein. And if you change the amino acid in a sequence, you change the knitting structure of the protein. So a mutation, which is a change of the DNA code, can lead to a protein with an altered structure, and as a result of an altered structure, may not function appropriately. These kinds of mutations are called spontaneous random mutations, meaning it wasn't the intention of the cell to make a mutation. The intention of the cell was to copy it with fidelity, copy the DNA to make two copies, one to go in each daughter cell. It was never the intention to make the mistake. When a mistake occurs, it's random, meaning it was no particular reason why this particular base pair was changed for another, like you change a G for a T. It would just accidents happen like that, random. In this understanding, then it says that evolution, the reason why we're here today, is a net result of billions of years of accidents in DNA reading and writing. basically, it's sort of like we got here like shaking genetic dice, that every now and then you shake the dice and you get a different answer, and all of a sudden you change the proteins and then you get a different organism. So we talk about evolution as a slow, gradual process, the result of spontaneous, random mutations that lead to changes in the structure of the proteins, which lead to changes in the structure and function of the organism, and that over the billions of years, evolution is a result of just fortuitous accidents among random mutations. And so why this becomes relevant is a couple of very important reasons. One of them is basically, if you ask a question, what is the purpose of life? And you start with the premise that it was all an accident, then you must have to unfortunately conclude there is no purpose to life. And as a result, too many people have been really believing that we walk this planet just totally by accident. While they're here, it's like, cool, do whatever you want. You're an accident anyway, and there you go, you're done, and whatever you did to the Earth is the footprint that you made. And why this becomes relevant is that it separates us from the environment as not having any purpose or connection with our environment. We just got here by a series of accidents. Through epigenetic mechanisms, we reveal now that a lot of the changes are not accidents at all, that they're actually designed by the environment. But how can we account for that? Because our conventional understanding is the mutations were just copying errors. Well, it's real interesting because the more biologists looked into this copying mechanism, the more they started finding something that was really an unknown support system, which is now recognized, and it's called repair mechanisms. It says that when the DNA is copied, all the nuclei have enzymes in there, proteins, whose function it is to compare the old DNA with the new copy, and if a mistake has occurred, it will repair it. So here's a surprising point. We attribute all of our evolution to these random accidents and then come to find that these spontaneous random mutational events are almost always covered and repaired for by the repair mechanism. So all of a sudden it says, well, that then makes it less likely that all the accidents that led to evolution got here by simple random processes, because there was a mechanism to avoid that, to maintain fidelity, that when the daughter cells divide, they pass on equal amounts of information and the same information they receive from the parent cell. So it turns out there was some doubt about as, well, how can you get evolution if we have a repair mechanism? Well, interestingly enough, there was a major paper, which I believe ultimately down the line is going to net John Cairns, a geneticist from Great Britain, a Nobel Prize. When he first wrote this paper, the paper was in the 1988 journal Nature. The title of the article was On the Origin of Mutants. And John Cairns did this amazing study. He took bacteria that had a mutated enzyme. The enzyme is the protein. It's mutated because the gene was altered. And so when it made this enzyme and the enzyme folded up in the right configuration, the structure was incorrect because of the mutation and it didn't work. The enzyme is called lactase. Lactase is a protein enzyme whose job it is to bind to a signal, lactose. And when binding to the signal, the lactase enzyme changes its shape and breaks the lactose down in a process of digestion. So that's actually how the enzyme works. The lactase enzyme has a place to bind lactose. When this lactose signal shows up, remember, a signal binds to a protein, causes the protein to change shape. In this case, as the protein changes shape, it breaks the lactose molecule into subunits, which then are later broken down into building blocks by the cell. And so the cell can eat lactose, digest it, and get energy and building blocks from this digestion process. But Cairns starts with bacteria where this enzyme doesn't work because it's mutated, so it can't digest lactose. He puts these bacteria in the petri dishes where the only nutrient is lactose. Well, if you were one of those bacteria, you'd find this to be a very threatening environment. Essentially, you'd be like thrust in the middle of the Gobi Desert with no food to eat anywhere. All the lactose you're standing on, you can't use because the enzyme that you have, lactase, doesn't work. The net result of such an experiment, the anticipation of the result, is nothing will happen. The cells will not grow. They may not die, but they won't grow. And the reason why they won't grow is simply this. To grow and to divide, cells need to take in metabolites, digest them, and then use the energy to double the organism. So a single cell will actually double itself to create two cells which separate from each other. But in these bacteria, you put them in a petri dish, and the medium is lactose. Their enzyme lactase doesn't work. They can't digest it, so they can't get metabolic building blocks, and they can't get energy, so they are not really allowed to divide. So nothing should be growing in any of the petri dishes. Yet, in a large number of the dishes, Cairns found that bacteria started growing colonies. And he said, well, wait a minute, how can that happen? The only way that can happen is if the enzyme was now working. So somehow or other, some condition pushed the enzyme into working. So the conventional thought is, well, all mutations are random. So Cairns wanted to verify in all the petri dishes, every time he did the experiment, are the mutations random? Meaning this, if I look at the mutations in petri dish 1, are they different than the bacteria have in petri dish 2, which are different from the bacteria that are alive in petri dish 3? If I compare them, if all mutations are random, then there should be random results in each one of these experiments. So the first thing he did is he looked at the types of mutations. There are 6 or 7 different ways that DNA can be mutated. When he looked at the experiments, he found that all of the cells that survived used the same type of mutation. So right away, that was like, oh, wait a minute. If it was random, there should have been different kinds of mutations in one dish versus found in a different dish. And yet, all of them had the same type of mutation. So that didn't fit the hypothesis. The other thing was the hypothesis is that mutations would be random scattered throughout the genome, so that the bacteria in the stressful environment maybe just mutates a lot of genes, and that fortunately in the ones that survived, they corrected the mutation by another mutation of the lactase enzyme, and that's how they survived. But when Cairns looked at where the genes were that were mutated in the genome, they found that almost all the mutations were focused around just the lactase gene. Well, this completely shocked him because it was completely unexpected on the basis of our normal understanding of mutations. A, they weren't random, and B, the bacteria, the most primitive organism on the planet, essentially, didn't just randomly pick any gene to mutate. It identified the gene where the stress was and mutated that gene. And so Cairns writes this article about the nature of the fact that the environment led to a stress that directed the mutation to occur and repair the lactase enzyme. And how could it do this when the cells weren't dividing? And this was like the big shock. It found out that our conventional thought was the only time DNA is copied or changed is when the cell is dividing. That's when you're, of course, doubling the DNA. But Cairns found that when an organism is stressed, it doesn't divide at all. But it does activate some genes to copy themselves and make lots of copies, but using a special protein to copy the DNA. That what's unique about this protein is that it's error prone, meaning every time it copies the gene, it puts error into it. It's not the same DNA copying mechanism that is used when a normal cell is dividing and it wants to have two daughter cells exactly the same. The copying enzymes for the DNA assure in that case that both copies are exactly the same as the original and the new are going to be exactly the same because I want both daughter cells to have exactly the same DNA. But in a stress situation, when it identified that the genes associated with lactose metabolism weren't working right, the cell selected those genes to be copied, but by an enzyme that induced mutations. So it's a completely different event. The organism is making mutations with an intention. The reason is this. The current gene doesn't work, so keeping that just the same way will keep me in the same problem. So it uses a mechanism to copy the gene and induce errors. So there's a process where you amplify the number of genes by copying them, but you hypermutate them, meaning that every copy will be slightly different than the original one. And then when you get large numbers of these genes, any of the gene that has been copied and the error corrected will then make an enzyme that can be used. And the one that can make a new version with a working lactase, that new version is actually put into the chromosome. The old non-functional copy of the gene is cut out, and the new copy with the modified version is put in. And he wrote this article talking about how mutations are not necessarily random, that mutations are influenced by the stresses that the organism perceives in the environment, and that the stresses directly select which genes are the problem genes, and the system has a mechanism to actually generate mutations. And this is like a 180-degree difference from our conventional point of view that all mutations are accident and random. This says that mutations can be selected and purposeful. Well, when he published the article in 1988, I loved it because the journal editors, they didn't want to publish the article because this completely pulls the rug out of our conventional understanding of evolution and Darwin's theories that life is not maybe random. And the British, they couldn't not put the article in for this reason. When John Cairns did this research, he was already a world-recognized leader in genetics. So the editors couldn't really say, well, we're not accepting the article because obviously this is false and your work is questionable. They couldn't say that. So they published the article, but they did put an editorial in the journal. And it's interesting because the British have a sense of humor. And the title of the editorial, which came right after the paper, was A Unicorn in the Garden. And in that British sense of humor, it meant a unicorn was a fantasy. The garden was the biosphere. And what they said was, well, we published this work. We have grave doubts that it's real. And it's a fantasy. It just can't be because we obviously know we live in a Darwinian world based on random mutations. The concept that an organism, especially something as primitive as a bacterium, can change its genes with any kind of intelligence just didn't fit. It was interesting because 1 week later, the American Journal Science wrote an editorial that slammed Cairns' work, and it's just wonderful because the Yanks, they didn't express that sense of humor. Their editorial was big, bold, black letters that says, a heresy in evolutionary biology. And they just claimed that it was unthinkable that anybody could really believe that bacteria could change their genetics in response to the stresses they have in their environment. They just said that was the most unlikely possibility of all. And they just tore a big one for Mr. John Cairns. But the interesting thing about it is John Cairns' work was right. That it's taken a number of years, but we finally have come along to understand that there are mechanisms that cause mutations when an organism is stressed, and that these mechanisms are involved with rewriting the genetic code to upgrade the organism to fit the environment that they're in. The relevance about this is very important because it really says that we are not here by randomness. We're here by an intention and purposeful design of nature. That this is not an accident, that we are an integral part of the environment, adjusting ourselves continuously with the environment as all other organisms do. This kind of evolution is not Darwinian at all. It's actually Lamarckian evolution. And it's interesting because most people don't even know of Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck. Lamarck is a French biologist who published the theory of evolution in 1809, 50 years before Charles Darwin. Lamarck's theory of evolution was the first scientific theory of evolution. It was usurped by Darwin and not recognized. He didn't identify where he got his information from, but it was usurped by Darwin. And yet Lamarck had an interesting theory. He was the first one, A, to identify that evolution occurred. But in regard to mechanisms, he suggested the following. He suggested that organisms change as a result of the parents experiencing the world they live in, finding it somewhat stressful, and then changing the genetics of their offspring so that the offspring will be better adapted to live in the environment. Lamarck called this the inheritance of acquired characteristics, that an organism would acquire a characteristic by dealing with the environment and then pass that characteristic on to their offspring. There was an experiment in the early part of the 1900s by a German scientist, August Weismann, who wanted to slam Lamarck on this because he didn't believe Lamarck. He said, no, environmental alterations cannot be passed on to their offspring, because Weismann found that germ cells, the cells that form sperm and egg, separate from the body cells real early in development. And so his premise was this, since the germ cells are already separated from the body, if the individual's body experiences something and changes something in its genes, it wouldn't go back to the germ cells because the germ cells were already separated from the body cells so that their programs would be unaffected by the life of the individual.